This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Don't get too excited that this is happening in every ed school across the true. Land.
We generally did not accept any Marxists for the program, as a general rule.
Yeah, I'm hopeful too.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Joe Flacco of Education Policy, Morgan Polakoff.
Pleasure to be here.
Morgan, you are an assistant professor at the Rasier School of Education at the University of Southern California. Folks out there probably know your work on No Child Left Behind, among other issues. And you are in town for what we like to call our EEPS program, Emerging Education Policy Scholars program that we do with AEI. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Morgan, you and about, 15 or 20 other young, promising scholars are in town this week to talk education policy.
It's a great chance to be in town and also to rack up some airline miles.
Yes, that is true. There you go. Yeah, are you going to do some other fun things while you're in the city? You're going to do some sightseeing, go check out some memorials?
You know, I need to get over and see that new MLK memorial. I haven't done that, actually.
Yes, although they're going to change it. Did you hear they're going to do some editing?
Oh, yeah, because they didn't like the quote that they put up. Yeah.
Seems like that could have been something they might have wanted down before. It's, this does make me feel better. Occasionally when I want to tweak a blog post after I've published it.
Right. Etched in granite.
Yes, that makes me feel better. All right. Well, lots to talk about. We're glad to have you here, and we've got the great education news to cover. So let's start. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, get us started.
As outlined in this weekend's New York Times, some contend that gifted and talented programs favor middle-class students, thus creating social castes within schools. Is there something wrong with these programs?
Morgan, what's your take on this? People say, oh, gifted and talented, this is just a way for those white parents to keep their kids around those other kids.
Well, you know, I mean, these discussions are actually very parallel to the affirmative action discussion. So, I mean, the issue is what happened is New York decided that they would switch to a test-based criterion to decide who gets into these programs. And whenever you have a program where people are selected into it just on the basis of a test score, you're going to have more white and Asian students and less black and Latino students. I mean, this is also true of Stuyvesant High School, one of the best public high schools in the country in New York. It's mostly white and Asian. So, you know, what are the problems? I mean, if it really is not identifying students who are gifted and talented but don't show it on tests, then that's a problem. It's also a problem if students in the general ed program are getting, you know, all kinds of bad instruction because they happen to be in a general ed program. So I think the real issue is that we need opportunity to learn whether they're in the gifted program or whether they're not in the gifted program.
All right, I buy that. And we know that there has been a history in this country of having the lower tracks or the regular programs have bad instruction or kids sit around filling out dittos all day while the gifted kids get to do challenging work. Okay, I get that. At the same time, I worry a lot that articles like this feed this idea that we should just get rid of gifted and talented programs because they're elitist or all kids are gifted, so they all deserve this. I think there's got to be a place in our education system where high-achieving kids can get the challenge that they need. And it is really hard to do that in a heterogeneous grouping, in a regular classroom, especially in these diverse schools where you've got some kids who are, you know, 2-3 grade levels ahead and other kids who are 2-3 grade levels behind. You know, don't tell me that one teacher is going to be able to handle that if all the kids are grouped in together.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think the thing is, when you've got a situation where in the whole of the Bronx, you've only got a couple kids identified as being gifted and talented, you might want to think about having different criteria, perhaps for different areas, or having a certain percent of kids in each school be in the gifted program. You know, that's another alternative that would probably make the programs a little bit more diverse, and at least you'd have some exposure. You know, the strongest kids in each school would get access to this kind of stuff. So
yeah, and look, I think about this in terms of as a parent, and my book that came out in the fall, The Diverse Schools Dilemma. You know, it seems like we want to tell these parents, say the white parents, middle class parents, hey, we want you to stay in these urban environments and not move to the suburbs, not do white flight. We want you to send your kids. But then we can't tell those parents that, well, I'm sorry, your kid's going to sit there and not learn anything all day long because they're in a classroom that can't go as fast as your kid's ready for. Or, you know, there's no way that that's tenable. You've got to be able to make sure that every kid has a chance to learn something new every day. And so for high-achieving kids, that's going to mean that at least part of the day, they need to be around other high-achieving kids going at a faster pace.
Yeah.
All right, topic number two.
Last week, Education Week released the 2013 iteration of its annual Quality Counts report card, which assesses the state of American education. Maryland took top honors for the first... Oh, geez. This is actually kind of a tongue twister. Last week, Education Week released the 2013 iteration of its annual Quality Counts report card, which assesses the state of American education. Maryland took top honors for the fifth time in a row and was followed by Massachusetts, New York, and Virginia. Are these really the best education systems in America?
Morgan?
Well, listen, I mean, what they do is it's like a little bit like U.S. News and World Report. They take this strange concoction of indicators, some of which are about student performance and some of which are about strange things like, you know, teacher salaries, and they put it all together and they give you some grade. If I were measuring the performance of states, what would I want to know? I would want to know which states are having the best outcomes for their students, particularly relative to what's expected given, you know, the socioeconomic status of the students, and also which states are getting the biggest bang for their buck, you know, which states are being really efficient with dollars. And so you might just have indicators on everything else. So I think these grades are, you know, a little bit useful, but I wouldn't read too much into them.
You know, a lot of people have made a lot out of the fact that the grades for Quality Counts look very different than the grades for Students First from last week when they did a big report card. And so something like, say, Massachusetts and Maryland do very well in Quality Counts, do not look good when it comes to education reform on Students First. I look at these. Maryland's always been a tough one. I mean, I live in Maryland. Proud. Yes, good. Way to go, Maryland. There's no doubt that the NAEP scores are high and that they've made big gains on NAEP in the last 10 or 15 years. And there's a big mystery to me. I don't exactly know how to explain it because Maryland's not particularly a reformy state. It is a relatively small state. It's got relatively few school districts. And so, you know, a few of them moving in the right direction makes a big impact. And they have had some big important reforms at the district level. Massachusetts, that's an easy one to make a case, is definitely one of the leading. Again, strong scores on NAEP, big gains on NAEP, and for a lot of the subgroups as well. Some of these others, New York, Virginia, you know, are these simply states that are affluent? I mean, the Quality Counts metric, there's little doubt in my mind that it skews towards the more affluent states. Those states spend more.
Right.
They also have this weird chance for success indicator in there that's basically saying that, you know, the wealthier your state is, the more opportunities your kids have. And so it's this strange circular reasoning. You know, I would say that, you know, talking about making gains and bang for the buck, that Florida should certainly be on here as it was for Students First. And you know, New York is just perplexing to me. I don't know why we should be making much hay about New York. I mean, we just know huge achievement gaps.
New York is one of the states that is the least fair in terms of school funding, where rich kids get the most money and poor kids get the least. And there's all kinds of problems with New York.
All right, so let's all agree we like Massachusetts.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go with that.
There.
All right, topic number three.
Michelle Rhee has skyrocketed to fame, becoming what the Washington Post dubs an education celebrity. What makes her so fascinating?
Morgan, and is this going to fade out over time? I mean, what's your take? I mean, this was, as Andy Rotherham said, last week was Michelle Rhee week, it seemed like.
Right.
Front line. She was the student's first report, got a lot of play, and then this front page Washington Post story.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm actually one of the very few people who doesn't have a particularly strong feeling about Michelle Rhee. But, I mean, what is Michelle Rhee good at? She's really good at getting publicity. And also, she doesn't really mind making herself a target. So what I think you see is folks on the left, you know, sort of revile her and love setting her up as a target, and that she's this horrible, you know, when the Frontline documentary was on, I was watching my Twitter feed and it was like blowing up with people calling her a terrible person, and they're very personal attacks. And so, you know, I think she sort of fits into this sort of conspiracy theory mentality about corporate reform and all this stuff. So I think that's not really a bad thing. I mean, it would be great if they would attack her arguments more than her personally, but she's a lightning rod and she's fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I told the Washington Post about her, I think that she has brought attention to this issue that wouldn't otherwise be there. Right? I mean, she gets on television and, you know, radio and other things to talk about education. And the reason they have her on is because of Michelle Rhee, the person. She's interesting. Yeah. She's controversial, right? She has an interesting story. Those outlets experts don't necessarily want to talk about education policy.
Right.
It's a second tier issue and it's just wonky. But suddenly you personalize it and it, you know, becomes a story about villains or about, you know, conflict and about change. Then it's something that the press gets interested in. And that brings more attention to the issue. It brings more money to the issue, you know, all sorts of things, you know, for better or for worse.
Yeah. She's appealing on both sides because I think conservatives really haven't had someone like her to really be a champion. And then, like I said, liberals really like her as a lightning rod. Mm-hmm. She's very easy to attack for those sorts of personal things.
You know, I'm surprised people haven't talked more about Michelle Rhee, the Tiger Mom. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear a lot of her presentations and she comes from this perspective. You remember the book that came out last year, the Amy Chua book on the battle cry of the right. Tiger Mom. But, you know, this certain kind of upper middle class parent that wants to push their kids, many of whom happen to be Asian parents, but not entirely. But here's Michelle Rhee. You hear her talk about how, you know, her daughters who are terrible at soccer got trophies for playing soccer. Uh-huh. Isn't this horrible? And it shows this decline of standards. I mean, you can see these values about wanting an education system that is very much about pushing and about discipline and about achievement and about, you know, sort of no BS. And that appeals to a lot of people. But, you know, there's also a whole swath of the segment of population, including other upper middle class parents, to whom this sounds really, you know, kind of grating and stressful and not in line with their own values.
Right. For they don't want those kinds of schools for their kids.
Yeah, you know, and so that's another angle here too, is I think that that we've got to be careful that, you know, school reform is a big tent. And there's a lot of people who like the ideas, for example, of school choice, who are not going to be into the Tiger Mom kind of thing, who could be turned off by this.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, that is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, before you were here, Morgan Polakoff was on with me doing the show. He's had to leave now, but great program, this EAPS program of ours, huh?
We love the EAPS program. Yeah. Those guys are so helpful to us and to Rick Shop. You know, they help give us advice on our studies and sometimes chip in and actually conduct some of these things, and we get to trade ideas. So, big fan of the EAPS program.
We will do another round. So, if you're out there, you are a young, promising scholar going through a PhD program, look for that. Coming
Absolutely.
Up. You know, it makes me quite hopeful. I mean, there's been for so many years, we would just wring our hands about the low quality of education research. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many people that were going into education research were pushed into areas of study where it just seemed, you know, the sort of ridiculous titles that you would see
That's
at
right.
AERA.
Yep.
I think there's been a real change. And and look, I'm willing to give Russ Whitehurst a lot of credit here. That was another one of the things he got done at IES, was to fund a lot of programs and fellowships and things to get people doing more serious work and more serious training programs.
That's right. I mean, that said, we also selectively cherry pick these students that we think are really good, and we get by word of mouth. So
that's right.
Don't get too excited that this is happening in every ed school across the land.
We generally did not accept any Marxists for the program as a general rule.
Yeah, I'm hopeful too.
All right. What you got for us this week?
So we have a new study out by UC and Texas A&M researchers that examines whether multiple choice tests induce actual retrieval of information from prior learning or simply quick recognition of an answer when compared to a fill-in-the-blank test. So in other words, you know, there's a lot of brouhaha around multiple choice tests. They're controversial. Some say, you know, this is really an efficient way to get an idea of students' knowledge and skills. Others say it makes it easy to teach the test, and it actually shows very superficial knowledge of the content when you actually show kids the correct answer. So researchers conducted two small sample studies, so important to keep in mind. One had just 32 undergrad participants, the other one 96. One's experiment was at UCLA, the other at University of Washington or Washington U. So these are exploratory findings. I want to just underscore that. But that said, I was kind of fascinated by the study. Mm-hmm. So they had students read two 1,100 word passages. They gave them initial and final tests. They alternated the multiple choice and the fill in the blank test in the order in which they were given, as well as they included control items from non-tested passages and items that could be viewed as competitive incorrect alternatives. Mm-hmm. So having been a teacher myself, I know what that means. It means you're trying to like trip the kids up with a really, you know, an answer that could be viable as opposed to just throwing in a freebie.
Mm-hmm.
They found that bubble tests with competitive responses trigger actual knowledge retrieval processes rather than simple recognition processes. They do so better than fill-in-the-blank test. They also found that having multiple-choice practice questions facilitated the recall of related but not explicitly tested information. So, in other words, when you have these other plausible incorrect answers right beside the right answer, your brain starts saying, okay, how do I knock out these alternatives? You know, so while you're trying to decide on the correct answer, you're kind of going through the other one saying why they're not the correct answer. So the authors say that these tests can be constructed so that they mimic retrieval processes that they are actually accused of bypassing. One last thing. When they were given feedback, however, corrective feedback on their answers, whether or not they took fill-in-the-blank or multiple choice test, the recall on the second test was the same because they took multiple tests, regardless of whether they took a multiple choice or a fill-in-the-blank test. So in other words, it's really, if you're going to give kids feedback, it doesn't matter what kind of test they take, they're actually going to be better at recalling that.
All right. So this is good news for multiple choice tests, which, by the way, tend to be cheaper, right?
That's right.
Easier, certainly easier to score. You can do that in a very computerized way. A little bit harder if you have a fill-in-the-blank kind of test.
That's right.
But the key is that you got to make sure you have plausible alternative answers.
Right.
I was thinking about this. Like, so let's say we did a quiz and we said to college men, okay, the woman that you took out last night, what color were her eyes? Now, and if it was a fill in the blank, right, they had to fill it in versus saying, okay, were they green, blue, or brown?
Brown.
Right.
Right.
Now the easiest would be, you know, were they blue, red, purple, or yellow. Right. Then that would be easy. But as long as it's alternative, then you really, they all of a sudden, they're like, oh God, I don't know. Were they blue or were they brown? I can't remember.
Right. So, I mean, and this is hard stuff when you're a classroom teacher. I mean, I did this once upon a time, trying to come up with, you know, viable answers to multiple choice questions, you know, where you want to really, you don't want to like trick the kids, but you also want to really know that they know how to distinguish among very viable answers,
right.
You know, where you have to get them to think through each one of the options and not just circle that one because, oh, that's
obvious.
You know, that's obvious and it's easy. So the fact that some of these tests can be constructed where kids actually have to think through each option is really encouraging. Right.
Do we know if the Park and Smarter Balance tests are going to have multiple choice or what the formats are going
to
be?
They have to, right? I thought there was going to be multiple. I know there's some long essay, you know, and of course I'm not going to remember which is which, but yeah.
Well, I would think, and I guess I'm answering my own question here. The Smarter Balanced is supposed to be computer adaptive.
Yes.
So therefore, it must have
multiple
choice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could have fill in the blank in a computer, maybe.
Yeah,
and
both
they could
of them are
going to
have a component of that.
Yeah. But it's certainly not going to be here, write a 200-word you know, response, and then the computer somehow analyzes it and decides what happens.
Yeah,
next.
I don't know if they're going to have teacher. I mean, I just don't know, but I know they're going to have some extended response.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably is going to be 250 words, and like a paragraph.
But that piece can't be adaptive,
right?
Obviously. All right. Well, good. Good news for multiple choice tests. Good. All this talk about next generation testing, forget about it.
Just give them those bubble tests and be done with it.
Fine the way it is. All right. Thanks, Amber. That's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Morgan Polakoff.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.